What did you wake up to today? Was it a medieval castle, an ancient cathedral, or a charming cobblestone village? With a bed that faces the passing scenery, Avalon gives cruisers a front row seat to the views of the world with immediate access to a new port every day. Open your eyes to a different kind of cruising, one with smaller ships, bigger experiences, fewer people, and more of everything. Limited time special offers await at avalonwaterways.com.
HudsonRiverRadio.com. It beats listening to nothing.
Being Frank, where the only way to be is Frank.
Hello and welcome to Being Frank, where the only way to be is, of course, Frank. I'm your host, Frank Lebuono, and we'd like to thank you for joining us here on what we like to call the Intelligent Conversation Podcast. We know that your time is valuable and competition is fierce, lots of podcasts out there, but we like to think of ourselves as an alternative to all that noise. So we really appreciate you sharing some of your day with Being Frank. You know, we stream from HudsonRiverRadio.com in beautiful and historic Stony Point, New York, where the mailman, I call him that because he always delivers, Mr. Neil Richter, is our engineer. That's our so-called home base. But remember, you can download us wherever and whenever you listen to your favorite podcasts. That includes iHeartRadio, Spotify, Apple, Spreaker, and all the others. You can find links on our Hudson River Radio Facebook page. And please think about becoming a subscriber and leaving us a comment or two. We also have our own website, HudsonRiverRadio.com. And if you go to the site and click on the Being Frank link, you'll see it on the left side. I think we're third down. You'll be able to listen to any of our podcasts anytime. If you like the program, please consider sharing it with family and friends. You know, Being Frank brings our audience a new topical program every week, beginning on Thursdays. But you can listen at your convenience. Remember, every program is also archived, so you can listen to any Being Frank virtually anytime you want to. We think it's the intelligent thing to do. And again, for some context, we are going live to tape here the last day of August the 31st. A mathematical genius, a formula that speeds up space travel called Shortcut, his loving wife. When Laura Max disappears after an attack that leaves Jason Max in the hospital, his only goal is to find her and bring her back. Then he gets a message from Voyager 1. Laura is alive in space. To get her back, he'll do whatever it takes, even taking on government agents who might try to stop him, racing against the clock to perfect the formula and the system that relies on it and find a suitable craft to take him out there. Jason finds he needs more than math to succeed this time. An unforgettable near future, hard science fiction thriller from the producer of Donnie Darko and A Time to Kill and the number one best-selling author and first editor of Andy Weir's The Martian, Shortcut will have you on the edge of your seats. Joining us now to discuss his book, Shortcut, a Jason Mass thriller, the movie, and so much more, Brian Thomas Schmidt. Excuse me, I said Jason Mass, Jason Max. Brian, thank you so much for joining us here this evening. Pleasure to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get into Shortcut, your new, latest novel of many, by the way, you're author of many novels. You're an editor. We're going to talk a little bit about that. You write in many different genres. But let's talk a little bit about you and how you got into writing. In the first place, were you always into it? As a kid, did you find yourself writing? Did you come to it later? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, my mom says I never played with the toy the same way twice. And I used to get frustrated when it wouldn't do all the things I could imagine. So I guess I'm kind of a natural storyteller because even in, you know, my playpen, I was trying to tell little stories with my stuff, you know. So I think I came to it that way. And then as time went on, I went into it and developed the craft and learned to start telling stories. But it's always been something I've kind of leaned toward. Started out like most people do, writing fanfic of my favorite children's books with like friends in grade school and that kind of thing. And eventually I would write TV scripts to my favorite shows as I watched and stuff, and then kind of moved into more other things as time went on. So
it's interesting. And as I mentioned, you do quite a bit of editing as in addition to your own work, you edit others. And again, and from all different genres, but you seem to gravitate mostly, not exclusively, but mostly towards science fiction, sci-fi. Why, Brian? Why does that mode seem to grab you more than the others?
Well, I'm actually moving towards thrillers primarily. This is a science fiction thriller. My last three novels have all been thrillers, including, and this is the fourth. So I can say that I'm doing more thriller and mystery. That's my next book is a mainstream mystery. But the reason sci-fi started out is because I am of the generation that Star Wars made us want to be storytellers. When Star Wars A New Hope came out in 77, my cousin said, let's go see this movie called Star Wars. And I thought, what a dumb name for a movie. You'd think they could come up with something more sophisticated, right? So then I go to this movie. My cousin's already seen it like 17 times. He goes, trust me, you're going to love it. So I go, and I was blown away, and I fell in love with robots because there were these two amazing robots called R2-D2 and C-3PO, and, you know, the whole story was so fantastic. It just made you, I mean, it was, I'd seen all the different things before that. I'd seen some episodes of Star Trek. I'd seen Doctor Who, which back then was kind of like, hey, look, a cabbage wrapped in tinfoil. Run away, run away. You know, so, but Star Wars took it to a whole new level with the special effects and the realism of it that just really made me excited about the stories and stimulated my creativity. So science fiction is kind of the first love where I started. And that's kind of why I, you know, started there. Ironically, the first book I wrote was not science fiction. It was actually a love story, kind of like the Nicholas Sparks. And that book has actually been rewritten, is done, and will be out at some point. But actually before that I wrote a nonfiction book, come to think of it. I forgot about that one. But anyway, the point is, I took kind of a circuitous path, but science fiction is very much a passion of mine. And I like science. And I like to explore the central theme of most science fiction and fantasy too is what if. And so I like that central question. What if? The you know, positing different possibilities is a fun thing to explore.
Well, you know, I did some reading of your work, and I did notice that there is quite a bit of science, actual science, real science, if you will, and math in your work. That seems to be an important element. Is that a fair statement to make, that that's one of the things that you like to include?
I would say it's a fair statement about Shortcut particularly. There's a lot of real math and science there because the story required it. Now, when it comes to the John Simon thrillers, which are the three books I wrote before this, and there'll be another one coming, those are more procedural. And yeah, I went along on real ride-alongs, and I studied real technology and real trends, and I really wanted it to be more, you know, kind of near future and you know, as close to accurate of what believable in that sense. I'd say I go for believability, so I really want things to be as close. My original first story was kind of a Star Wars like space opera, and that was a little more off the deep end. But this, what I'm gravitating towards now, is more of real stories, because to me they speak to me more in the real world. So stories that at least could be plausible, you know. So that's where the science and math tends to come in, is working with technology and things that are familiar, maybe taking them to the next level, but not that far beyond what we can imagine is possible. Because to me, that really makes me feel more connected, and I think it makes readers feel more connected in some ways.
Well, it's a perfect segue to my next question. And you said, well, what motivates you to write then? Is there any particular thing that you mentioned Star Wars as a particular epiphany? Are there other things that you hear or see that will motivate you to write? What do you use for your motivation?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of big questions I'm always looking for answers for. I was the geeky kid. I was the kid who got bullied a lot, got picked on. I was also the kid who kind of felt like the black sheep in my family. So I kind of felt alone a lot of it. So there was a lot of the questions of who am I and what makes me valuable as a person? What makes, you know, what makes you a man? What's important? Those are important questions for anybody, but that is something that in particular resonates with me. My dad was a farm boy. He became a doctor. He's very much into the working outside, getting sweaty thing. I never found appeal in that. So that definition of manhood was always kind of like, that's what a man was to him because he grew up with that. So for me, I always felt like maybe I wasn't a man, you know, not that my dad ever specifically called me not a man. Okay. I want to be clear about that. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that there was just that feeling that I was letting him down, you know, cause I was different. And so all of those are kind of questions that are part of it. The coming of age into your own was a big part of that for me. So figuring out, okay, who am I? What do I want to be? And can I be that and be okay? So there's lots of those kind of questions that come in with my characters too. And then there's bigger questions, you know, spending time as a loner, being picked on, kind of feeling outside. You know, there's a theme, we'll talk about it later more with Shortcut, but there's a theme a lot in my work of learning that you're not necessarily alone, and you don't necessarily need everybody, but you do need somebody, and that you're part of a larger community, and it's okay to contribute to that, even if you don't get anything back. That's probably a common theme for me.
Where would you get some of your ideas? I mean, I know sometimes when I'm walking, I'll see or hear something, it'll motivate me to write. You know, I do blog as well.
Well, I grew up evangelical Christian. I'm kind of more of the middle ground these days than I was. But the first stories I wrote, the Davi Re, were actually the Moses story set in like a Star Wars setting and told as an epic space opera. And that was a lot of fun. But, you know, everybody knows the Moses story. So as I started actually writing, I thought it up when I was 15 and followed the Moses story like straight through. But when I got to actually writing it like 25 years later or whatever, I said, I got to make up some stuff so people don't know what's going to happen every 5 seconds. You know, I had to kind of figure it out. So that's what kind of made me kind of play off of things. So I play off a lot of that. With a lot of it is my sense of humor. I'm always wanting to put people in awkward situations where I can evoke humor. So John Simon is a technophobic old school cop in Kansas City. And his partner is kidnapped and murdered, his pregnant partner. And the only witness is an android, a humanoid android. So he has to work with this guy. And they end up becoming partners, and the android joins the force. And that's a whole different thing in the other stories. But at first, he's working with an effing robot. He doesn't want to work with a robot, man. You know, this is a stupid robot that, you know, he doesn't believe in, right? So he, you know, that clash. And then the robot, of course, is trying to be more accepted and be more human. So the robot starts quoting, you know, the cop movies and doesn't know the right context. So he's saying things, but at the inappropriate times and different stuff. So there's a lot of comedy. That's how I milked that, you know, that series was, it's kind of got a mix of, I call it, it's like Asimov's Caves of Steel, which was a noir story about a cop and a robot partner, mixed with Bosch, which is one of the greatest procedural series ever made, and it's based on Michael Connelly's books, and that's on Amazon. And then I mixed with Lethal Weapon, with that sense of humor of the buddy cop thing and lots of action. So that's kind of how I describe it. So that's where the ideas came from. Those three things, how do I combine them into a story and tell a story? That's one example. So, you know, ideas come from things I see or hear. I just got an idea for a story I'm going to write next from working with my audiobook narrators. And I want to do a story about audiobook narrators that are stalked for their voice. You know, crazed fan. Hey, you're the guy. Oh, you're the other guy. I hate you. That kind of thing. You know, I think that'll be interesting because, you know, lots of possibilities. I haven't necessarily seen all of them before.
Yeah. I want to get to in a moment or two. I want to get to you because you mentioned robotics and robots, et cetera. And of course, that conjures up images today of AI, artificial intelligence. I want to get your thoughts on that in just a minute. But before that, to wrap up a little, would you say you have a writing process? For example, Kerouac used to go and live clean for totally a week and sleep and be healthy so he could spend days and days on ends drinking, drugging, and just writing. That was his process for continuous. And there are many other people that have somewhat eccentric writing processes. I'm not suggesting that yours is. But do you have a particular process for when you write? Is there a place? Some people, I forget who it was, had his own writing cabin in his backyard.
Well, George R. Martin has to have that. That's one of the guys I know. I know George, and that's the thing he's really struggled with, is having to be in a certain place to be able to write. And he's got a cabin he often goes off to, but he also writes at home.
Right. So do you have a process like that?
For me, I don't have anything quite. I mean, yeah. Well, I sit down at my computer and I reread the previous day's stuff and tweak it, and then that gets me in the mode, and then I start writing, and I usually outline little TV guide outlines of a few scenes ahead of where I am, and I have the basic structure of the three-act story in my head, because I tend to follow the classic three-act Sid Field's paradigm structure in most of what I write. And so that's kind of my process. But as I get ideas, like my latest book I'm writing is a Will Dunlap mystery about a former missionary kid whose father was murdered in the Philippines. So he left and he went home and he kind of abandoned his mother there and his mother and his sister. Years later, he's a PI in Kansas City and somebody there comes and pays him money to go back and investigate, you know, a murder that ends up involving the grandfather of his girlfriend, and then his ex-girlfriend's dead. And so he's trying to figure out what's going on. So it's all set in the Philippines. All of that, there was a whole lot of research I've had to do, not only from language, but culture. I happen to have a fiance who's from the Philippines, so that helped. But I spent time with the police there. I have a police consultant. I have a former council member of the city council that's a kind of a member, one of my consultants. And I spent a lot of time reading books about the area and history and all that. So it's very research heavy. So it really depends. If there's a real research heavy thing, like Shortcut was very research heavy, there's a different process for a different book. But generally, like I said, I write in Scrivener, my first draft. Scrivener is a writing software that's $25, $35 that everybody can get. And I can save everything to Dropbox and then access it both on my laptop, my phone, or my iPad. So it's awesome. Wherever I go, I can write. So I'm not one of those guys that has to sit in a particular place. I can write in the dentist office. I've written a scene for like a few minutes and done it. I'm lucky that way. But I just need to be able to shut things off and focus for a little bit.
Well, you mentioned robots, robotics, and obviously for any a sci-fi writer, and of course going forward to any kind of thriller, might include AI because obviously the potential for harm done by it. But I don't want to put words into your mouth. That's never our point here. What are your feelings in general about artificial intelligence as a writer? Now we know there are writing programs that can write for you. So sometimes it takes the human element out of it. And then of course, within a sci-fi thriller or a thriller, again, like how the robot in 2001, the Terminator series, etc., the malevolent artificial intelligence. First, what are your feelings in general about AI? Do you think it could be a positive thing? And then as a writer, and then incorporating that into your work. But first, what are your general feelings about artificial intelligence? Good thing, bad thing, neutral thing?
Well, I've always found technology fascinated in general. So I do find artificial technology fascinating. Of course, going back to my love of robots, which I mentioned earlier. But the thing about this is these are tools. Now, you can get an AI to write you a book, but it's not going to have the soul and the heart of a human written book because there is no soul and heart behind it. There's a certain element that you cannot recreate. And, you know, so in general, people who think of them as a lazy tool that they can use to get by their own laziness, well, that's misuse of technology. That's not what it really is suited for. And you know, also you're stealing, if you use certain things that have been programmed by certain people's other, you know, data without their permission, that's a copyright violation, but it's also intellectual property. It's not your own. So, you know, the problem is you get this book that may be an amalgamation of all these different writers, Stephen King and Peter Kleins and Jonathan Mayberry and whoever's Jim Butcher, whoever's been programmed in there. The problem is it'll sound kind of like all of those, but it doesn't really sound like one person. And then when you start talking to describe your book, it's not going to sound like you either because it's not your voice. It's some fake voice that an AI created. So I think people have to be very careful. Anybody who thinks that's the way to write a book doesn't really understand the creative process or the role it takes. Even if you did have them AI help draft a book, you would have to do a lot of work on it to make it the kind of thing that would hold up with soul and spirit to somebody else. And that would be something that would really be your own thing in the sense that people would know, oh yeah, there's no way this guy wrote this book when you're having a conversation because you don't use any of the phrases or any of the words or you know what I mean? I mean, it's like, you know, anybody could use the AI to write a book, but can they really claim ownership? That's the question. So I think ethics is an issue here. I think it's important that any tool we get There needs to be some kind of understanding of ethics and rules for it. And since this is a technology that is, unlike many others in the past, actually capable of replacing human beings, artists in particular, we especially have to be very careful in how we deal with it. Because, you know, I don't want somebody writing a book when I'm dead in my name and claiming it we use the AI for it and saying it's a Brian Thomas Schmidt book, because it won't be. It won't be. And yeah, it's the same way. If you could recreate Harrison Ford in the context of Indiana Jones and de-age him for 30 years, well, that's pretty cool when you watch Dial of Destiny. But he sure as hell doesn't want a robot doing all his acting for him by making up images. You know, that's a whole different ballgame. And I think so. That's a proper use of technology, taking years of footage of him and using it to help de-age him for scenes in a movie so they could tell a story that goes back in time. That's pretty cool, and that's great use of it. Replacing an actor and just, you know, saying we don't have to pay him his multi-million-dollar salary, we could just make a Harrison Ford movie. That would be a different ballgame, I think.
Right.
I think even with, you know, there's people that, for example, when they put Carrie Fisher in one of the Star Wars films, and there's some other things too where they've done it with a couple other people, but I don't remember the names. It's always been a real actor actually acting on the scene with the other actors, and then they kind of modified the voice and the face and body a little bit with the technology. So it there's still a human involved to give it the inflection and all of that. So I think it's important to remember that the successful incarnations of it still involve human beings very much.
Well, you know, again, before we go to the break, one more thing I want to deal with a little bit is the process of editing. You know, because it's also part of the reality of things boiling down to their essential. And I know that's an important process for you, because you not only write, you edit as well, and quite a bit, anthologies and other people's works. Why is editing important, and in particular for you? What and I think people need to understand, editing is more than just shortening something. It's well, finding. But please, why don't you explain?
No, go ahead. I mean, yeah, I'm sorry, I didn't interrupt you.
No, please. It's just to lead you into that question. Please do it.
Yeah. Well, for me, first of all, the reason I got into editing is because I like helping other people be successful. And I saw an opportunity for me to work alongside some of my heroes in anthologies and some of the writing people that I admire, like Robert Silverberg, who I just co-edited a Robots anthology with, who's a grandmaster and a legend. And, you know, Kevin J. Anderson, Jonathan Mayer, there's a whole long list of people that I've worked with. I worked with, let's see, who else? Robin Hobb, a bunch of different people. Anyway, the point is, the chance to work with these great people and learn from them at the same time, contributing by helping them clean things up a little bit, but also examining story and helping them tell new stories and help young writers who haven't had that kind of exposure get big exposure, but also be able to have bragging rights of saying, I was in a book with, you know, I don't know, Orson Scott Card or Jonathan Mayberry or whoever, George R. R. Martin, whoever it is they admire. That was pretty cool, and that was helping people. So that audience from all those big-name people bleeds in and reads the stories by the people who are lesser known, and those people start building a fan base of their own. And so that's where I got into editing. Okay, so the first thing about editing is, true editing at its heart is helping other people to express themselves better, helping them tell whatever they're doing or write whatever they're doing in the best possible way. So that's the philosophy behind it. I think the thing about, you have to learn, I mean, a lot of people, especially starting out, will rewrite instead of edit. There's a big difference. And that's where you start walking on somebody's voice and you start changing things. I will do some of that when I need to show somebody a concept. But I always say, look, if this doesn't sound like you, take it and make it your own. Rewrite it. Make it in your voice. But this is the kind of thing I'm trying to do. It's very important to have that sensitivity and make that clear to your clients as well, so that, you know, they know that, you know, sometimes you just can't explain it without showing. You know, it's the same thing with show versus tell, which is one of the classic things that people talk about in writing craft. Sometimes you have to demonstrate it for somebody right there for them to really grasp what you're talking about, rather than just telling them about it. So you have to use good judgment about when to do that and when not to. So there's all of these kind of questions, a lot of nuance to the editing that I think is involved too.
My guest is best-selling author Brian Thomas Schmidt. His new work, Shortcut, a Jason Max thriller. We're going to continue speaking with Brian, hear a little bit, an audio clip from the book, which is in the process of being made into a film. So we have so much more of that on Being Frank, where the only way to be is Frank. I'm your host, Frank Lobono. We'll be back with so much more right after these brief commercial messages. Don't go away yet. This is a great show. Stay with us.
HudsonRiverRadio.com. Bring a dash of green into your life. Check out The Many Shades of Green with Maxine Margot Rubin and Malcolm Berman. Get informed about environmental issues and current events that affect us all. Pick a shade of green and raise your eco-consciousness with The Many Shades of Green. Available on Apple Podcasts, iHeart, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You ought to be in movies. Well, at least you should watch movies. The Silver Screen Podcast talks about all aspects of film and entertainment. Current films, old films, how movies are made, and interviews with movie makers, authors, and musicians, too. Check out the Silver Screen Podcast at HudsonRiverRadio.com or wherever you get your podcasts. And go watch a movie.
HudsonRiverRadio.com.
An epic love story taken across space and time. Can he find her? He'll do anything to get her back. Even cross the stars. Shortcut. An adventure you'll never forget.
Well, that was a bit of an audio clip from Shortcut, a Jason Max thriller from our guest tonight, best-selling author, Brian Thomas Schmidt. Welcome back, Brian. Welcome back to everyone. This is Being Frank. I'm your host, Frank Lobono, and we're discussing Shortcut, or we're about to, in some detail now. We learned a little bit more about its author, Brian Thomas Schmidt. Now let's learn a little bit more about Shortcut, its characters, its plot, etc. Okay, this makes my job easy. Tell us about it, Brian. First, Shortcut. It reminds me of the old, I don't know if you remember, if you were a fan of the old Odd Couple thing, and when, what's his name, sloppy guy was had to play himself as a reporter, and he puts his leg up and says, so tell us about your career, Slugger. And that's how the interview begins. So tell us about your career, Slugger. Now tell us about Shortcut. What is the plot? We got some of it from the trailer, but give us a little bit more detail. What could people expect from Shortcut?
Shortcut originated, and the original character was Jason Finale. I asked him to change the name because I thought Final was kind of a strange name for a character. Jason Max sounded a little bit cooler with two X's, you know, just for kicks. But Hunt Lowry, who is a producer in Hollywood, he's done a lot of movies, A Walk to Remember. He's done A Time to Kill. He's done Donnie Darko. And he's done, you know, worked with Bruce Willis. The movie Yaya Sisterhood that was out, he did. He's done a lot of cool stuff. And Hunt had an idea for a story about a mathematician who's married to an astronaut, and they're like, you know, perfect partners, lifelong loved. And he comes up with a theory, a math equation for how to use space travel in shorter increments and come across the galaxy to much faster, like in our own solar system, changing the time frames. You know, right now going to Mars, they're talking about years. Mm-hmm. All right. What if you could get there in a few hours? What if you could get there in minutes? So that was kind of the idea. And something happens to his wife, and he doesn't know what, but he believes she's still alive. And he sets out to perfect his formula and find a way to get her and bring her back wherever she is, whatever it takes. That's the basic premise. So we brought in a science guy who I call my personal Sheldon. His name is Jonathan Medagian, and he works at some kind of a major secret technology place. I don't know if it's a defense contractor. I honestly don't know because he's not allowed to tell me. But anyway, he's a very smart, very nice kid. probably in his late 20s when I met him. And we spent months working together, and he would write me these scientific papers every day and start with real science and say, here's the problem you posed in the plot. Here's where the real science is. Here's where I'm going to posit possibilities for the future. And we ended up, with his help and the help of a guy that Hunt had hired, who actually works at Caltech, I believe, and he is the author of some books. He's worked with people like Carl Sagan. I'm trying to look up his name because I'm forgetting what his name is. It's in the book, but Louis Friedman. Louis Friedman said, why don't you look at polaritons? Polaritons are microparticles, and there's a lot of research with polariton lasers. And basically the concept is, you'll actually see a drawing in the book of what it looks like. There's the scene breaks are all these little things, but basically you take two particles and you can move, displace matter and move an object across space. So basically, if you find a blank area of space, you take that blank matter of the same amount and you move the ship and all of its contents to replace that and put that back where the ship came from. And that's what a shortcut is. And it's basically kind of a difference between what the usual hyperspace travel that you see or even the travel of things like the transporter in Star Trek that we've seen that everybody loves. Whereas in this case, literally, I mean, so in seconds, you can move from boom, boom. It's like almost like a hyper jump. But in order to get to long distances, they have to execute a series of jumps to get there. And so you mentioned to me when we were first talking before I came on the show about the AI in the book. The part of the AI is part of that technology and shortcut where there's a rapid response system that basically RRCS, Rapid Reaction Control System, I believe is what it's called. Anyway, the point is, because of the fact that you're having to do these calculations, which are math calculations, and jump to all these different places, even though they're pre-planned for like NASA, Jason Max works with NASA, even though there's a bit of pre-planning on it, you need a ship that can immediately react even faster than humans can to changes in data. To what if there's a solar storm there? There's any number of issues and they have to reroute or they have to move the ship quickly or whatever. And so that's AI does that to help, help. And then the humans can, of course, take control at any time and can countermand the moves and whatever. But the AI is there to kind of help, them avoid immediate problems before they even realize they have a problem, that kind of thing. So that's the concept of shortcut that the book is based on. And basically, we start out with Jason, and NASA's doing its first test of shortcut with human beings. And there's some kind of issue that comes up. So he's feeling defeated because, he thought he had everything perfected. He doesn't know what's going on. But he ends up retreating. He gets in conflict with some of the NASA people about it. And they suggest that he go off and work at Caltech for a while with some old friends of his and try to figure out the problem. So he goes to Caltech, moves his family from Houston across the country to Pasadena. And a few days, months, I don't remember the time frame off the top of my head, but at some point after the move, I think it's a few months, he's with his wife out on a date night. They're in the park. And there's a group of people there that may be gang members. They don't know, but they kind of have similar outfits. And they end up getting in an argument. And then his wife just like disappears. There's a flash of light and she's gone. Doesn't know what's going on. And he's knocked unconscious right about the same time from the fighting. So she's disappeared. He doesn't know exactly what happened to her. But when he wakes up in the hospital a couple weeks later, he's determined to find her. I got to find her. She's the love of my life. I would know if she's dead and I can feel her. She's alive somewhere. How do we find her? So there's this whole police investigation going on about, okay, did the gang people kidnap or did these people kidnap? What's going on? And then Jason's doing his own thing, trying to figure out with, forensic evidence and other things, what happened to his wife. And get Laura and bring her back. Laura Max is his wife. She's a former astronaut. She was a space shuttle astronaut. Now she's teaching and training new astronauts at NASA. She's also a laser expert. So she helped him perfect the original polariton laser experiment that got him shortcut and made it work. And so he's you know, in the meantime, he's trying to take care of their daughter, Heather, and figure all this out. And, you know, coming up, whatever it takes, he's going to do it. And, you know, if you're trying to make anything move fast, you run into a lot of issues when it comes to space travel. And also just the whole, there's whole government oversight and all this stuff you have to deal with. So he has to struggle against all of that and try to, you know, get people to understand the urgency for him. And that's what the story is about. And it's basically about one man who's not perfect trying to figure out how to save the most important person in his life. And along the way, he realizes he can't do it alone.
That's what I wanted to bring up. That's kind of on the surface, obviously. And that's but what would you say is, if people were to read between the lines, are there some more of a subliminal message? Obviously, there's antagonist, protagonist, but often authors like to put a little something, a little message between what's obvious. Is there such a thing there?
Well, that I just gave you that actually at the end of what I was saying. What I was hinting at was the message. The message is that Jason is kind of he's a genius. He's a leader. He's used to pushing the boundaries, so he's used to kind of going out on his own and doing all of these things. Jason basically is used to kind of just having people. He's the genius. He tells you what to do and you do it. And he finds that to accomplish the mission of getting Laura back, he's got to rely on a whole lot of people, and that's not easy for him. And so that's a source of conflict, him with other people and different things. But along the way, a whole team comes to surround him of people. And by the end of the book, he realizes, you know what? I got her back, but I didn't get her back alone. I got her back because of all of you. And we are all part of humanity. And there's a lot of things that happen in the story that point to a higher importance and higher mission. And so, you know, all of it ends up, you know, being about more than just Jason and Laura. It's about something else. So there's a lot of elements to that. And they end up encountering, there's a first encounter element to the story. I don't want to give too much away, but there's a first encounter element to the story. And some different things. And he does go into space. I always tell people, it is kind of like The Martian, a little bit in reverse, because most of the story takes place on Earth before we actually go into space. And then at the end, we actually do go into space and end up, you know, with him rescuing her. The whole third act is basically in space. So before that is a lot of prep and figuring it out and all that. And that's where the math comes in. There's real math in the story. There's only really three pages in the entire 466 page book that have equations, but that scares people off. It's written in such a way that the math is there. So if you know math and you enjoy math, you can use the math and read the math and nitpick the math, but the math is not essential to your understanding of the story. So hopefully people can see the math and the science, and it's part of it and it's real. But it's written in such a way that you can understand and grasp what's going on at the same time.
Perfect. That was going to be my next question. You don't necessarily have to be a math geek, if you will, forgive the term, but to be able to appreciate the novel, you don't have to be a tech head, et cetera. But obviously, there are other people can find things in it beyond just the strength of the technology.
Well, I hope so. I mean, I was the first editor for Andy Weir in like 2013 when he was recommended from a friend of his that I was his editor for The Martian. And the number one thing that was good for me to edit it is because I don't have the science and math knowledge that Andy does. Andy's very, very smart about these things. He's kind of a computer tech guy and very much a space enthusiast. And so Andy understood all that stuff. Well, I was like, okay, what does this mean? Well, everybody knows what that means. I'm like, well, to me, this means this and this and this. Well, no, that's not what it means. These are scientific terms. I'm like, yeah, but you want to appeal to a bigger audience. You got to make it accessible. So I spent a lot of time working with him on that. Mm-hmm. And that was part of the lesson that I took writing Shortcut. We spent a lot of extra time making sure that it was accessible. Hunt and Patty, who worked with me on it at Rose Rock Films, don't really have that background either. So if they couldn't understand it, it had to be rewritten. So there was a lot of that. And so that's why I worked with Jonathan. He would give it to me in science, and I'd try to explain it. And if I misexplained it, he would help me fix it. And there was a lot of that work into it. So hopefully, like you said, it pays off and people don't have to have that science background and can really enjoy it. I think they'll enjoy the fact that It feels more real because it's there, but it doesn't get in the way of enjoying the story.
Hey, now it's the possibility of it being made into a film. Does that give it a little extra to you? The fact that it's being optioned for a film, does that change your attitude towards the book? Will it always be a novel first for you? If you see what I'm driving at?
When Hunt created it, he created several characters that are kind of the two main characters, Laura and Jason, and a few supporting characters. And he really had the first half of what would be a movie or a novel. He had kind of act one and part of act two. The rest of it, he had no idea what was going to happen. So when I came in, I ended up figuring out most of act three myself, but we kind of worked together to figure out the rest of it, at least act two. And I, you know, of course, created supporting characters and all that. But his original intention was to make a movie, but he wanted to develop the property first. And for whatever reason, felt that book properties are easier to sell. So he wanted to have a book that he could point to the studio and say, look, it's worth making because the story works. So he brought me in through my agent because I had edited The Martian. Probably thinking I was some kind of math or science genius, but he got a surprise. and then we did a lot of meetings, you know, a lot of Zoom meetings, a lot of phone calls. And then eventually I went out to L.A. and met in the Warner Brothers studios where he has offices and different things and all of that. And I also went out there because one part of my process, you asked me about my process earlier, especially with Near Future, is I actually go to as many locations as I can so I can represent it well. And then I sit there and I pick lots of pictures and a little recording, and I make note of all the things I see, hear, taste, touch, feel, all of that, so that I can use that. So that when I write about a location like Caltech or Johnson Space Center, both of which I visited in writing this book, I can actually evoke a sense of being there because I've actually been there, as opposed to just manufacturing what it might be like. So that was a big part of my process as well, that we did. And then, you know, we actually worked on this story for 2 or 3 years before COVID. And unfortunately, for various issues, it sat all during COVID. So I came back to it after COVID and spent some time just bringing it up to date and all of that. And now here we are. And so hopefully it's going to get made into a movie. Everything's on hold because of the strike right now, which, you know, we know in large part is about AI, among other things. So once that gets resolved, they'll be able to make some decisions. But, you know, hopefully by then the book will be successful. We're hoping. We're having a lot of good buzz about the book and a lot of people excited about it. So hopefully by the time it actually comes to that point, he'll have a real buzz to take to the studio and it'll get made. But if it doesn't, I own all the publishing rights. He owns all the film rights. And you know, even though we both get kind of a cut if that gets made into a film, the fact is that that's his problem. This is my problem. I don't know. I don't mean to. I mean, I consult with Hunt a lot about what I'm doing and let him know. It's not like I shut him out, but this is my area of expertise. That's his. So he kind of does that, and I do this.
You're yours. Now, you mentioned The Martian. It was kind of an offbeat but strangely successful film. I think it was more successful than people had anticipated it would be. About a man stranded.
People always ask me, you went into The Martian. Did you know it was genius when you read it? I'm like, no, I thought it was a pretty decent first novel, but there were problems with it. And it didn't make me say it was that, you know, this, I didn't know it was going to be an international phenomenon by any means. I thought it might be okay. I mean, some people will really get into this, but boy, it really took off. I mean, it just was the right time, the right thing at the right time. The reason they hired me was because they figured I had knowledge how to use real science and real math and tell a good story. It wasn't necessarily trying to be a sequel to The Martian or The Martian or anything like that. But it just happens to tie in well with that audience, I think. So that's good in one way.
Well, what do you think was the key to making The Martian a success? And it was had a critical success and some box office, and it relived again on cable TV. What success did you see there that you hope you can find in the shortcut as well?
Well, one thing that was really cool is that he made science and math cool.
Cool. Yes.
Which I hope we do too.
Yes. Cool.
I mean, you know, Mark Watney would say, I'm going to science the blank out of it, yeah, and that's I'm going to solve the problem, right? And he would, but then he would do all these really cool things that a lot of times you'd think, I didn't realize science could do that. And I think what we're doing with our story is we're showing you things math can do that you might never know. I mean, math really is, as Jason says at one point, the, you know, it's the language of the universe. And he likes being part of the dialogue that writes the universe. It can literally solve any problem that you come up with. There's a mathematical element to the solution. And so we're going to show you some things about math that maybe you didn't know before that are pretty cool. And I think that's kind of what we're doing. I hope people like that as much as they liked in The Martian. But the other thing is, there's a great sense of humor in that character. One of the things I struggled with in this was to find this a sense of humor in Jason. And I think we got it to some degree, but not, it's not nearly as much. You know, Mark Watney was a natural smartass. Jason couldn't be that because he needed other people so much and he had to work with other people. So there's a slightly different personality to him. But yeah, Mark Watney was always making smartass remarks, and there was a lot of fun to that. And, you know, when he examines all the belongings of his companions who are gone, you know, and it's funny, like, how the hell does, you know, so-and-so listen to this music? Or she's got a whole bunch of Bee Gees or something. What is this? You know?
Very clever. Yes. So, there was a wit about it. And he became an
important
character.
There was a wit.
You wanted to see him win.
Yeah, exactly. You just rooted for him. But I think, you know, everybody tells me that Jason is somebody you really root for, too. All the characters And that's good too. And that, I think at the, so I guess I'm kind of wandering around here, but the reality is, to answer your question, it's complicated, but at the fundamental basis level, he created a character that you wanted to see win. And that's what made that story work. You liked spending time with Mark Watney. You liked being in a room with him, and you cared about what he cared about because he was a normal, seemingly normal, decent guy who had problems that you could relate to. That's what made The Martian work. And that's what I'm hoping will work with Jason, even though he's a math genius and he has some other skills, is that people see, at the same time, he's a guy who loves his wife, who needs his wife, who loves his kid, and he'll do anything to keep his family safe. And I think everybody can relate to that.
The book, Shortcut, a Jason Max thriller, with his author, Brian Thomas Schmidt. Brian, where can people... People, I know it's out on Amazon. It's available now. Can you give us the information? Where can people get the book?
Well, you can order it through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kindle, even your local bookstore. You can order it because it's widely distributed through that. Also, it's out on audiobook a month later. It comes out September 15th. It's actually the release date. So right now it's on pre-orders, but it'll be out in a couple weeks from now. You can actually get your copies. And then if you want to order the audiobook, you can pre-order, but that's not actually releasing until the 17th because we just finished recording it like yesterday. So Stefan Rudnicki is going to do that. Yeah, he's a really great narrator who's won a lot of Audies and Golden Voice and Hugos for his audiobook work. And he's been doing this since we didn't even know there were audiobooks, like in the 80s. I mean, he's been doing this forever. He's a pioneer in the field. And so... So audio is also, the pre-orders are now available for that as well. So I think it'll be any format you want, anywhere you want to get it, you can find it. And I hope you'll go out. Just go out and look literally for Shortcut, a Jason Max 2X thriller, and you can find it anywhere.
What do you hear about the film? Any talk about it? Anybody cast yet for Jason or Laura? Any word on?
No, it's too early for all that.
Okay.
When the strike is over, they'll try to attach people. I mean, we batted some names around.
Who would you like to see? You created the character. Is there someone in mind that you think would be best suited to play that character?
Well, for me, when I wrote it, I was picturing, why am I blanking on his last name? The guy in Barbie, Ryan,
Gosling.
Ryan Gosling. Ryan Gosling. Yeah, right? Sorry, Ryan.
I remember from Barbie. I didn't see the movie, but I remember, yes.
Well, I like Ryan Gosling from The Notebook. I've liked him from The Notebook and a lot of other things. And The Notebook is one of my favorite romantic movies. But he was great in Lars and the Real Girl, which is a really unique, fun little story. And he's done a lot of stuff. And I've always thought Ryan Gosling was kind of he had the perfect combination of geek and macho that he could play somebody like Jason really well. But also an old friend of mine I worked with, he's probably a little old for it maybe, but Gerard Butler would be really good in this role too. He's got that element of it. So I don't know. I mean, whoever they get, obviously, I'm sure will be great at it. They might come up with somebody that we, you know, is new and up and coming that we've never heard of. Who knows? Jason's main sidekick is a guy named Peter Etz, and he's a character I created that works with him at NASA and Caltech. Peter Etz, to me, has always been Sheldon. So he's always been, you know, Jim. Why am I blanking on all my Hollywood names tonight? Yes. Anyway, Jim Parsons. Jim Parsons. I'm sorry, Jim Parsons.
Yes.
And the funny thing is, the really cool thing, actually, I told you guys I called my scientific consultant, Percival Sheldon. As a reward, he'd never been to a TV show taping. And so at Warner Brothers, when we were there, they took him on a tour of the studio and they got us tickets to one of the last episodes taping of The Big Bang Theory. So we actually got to see that. So that was a pretty cool, like, sympatico thing. So
very cool.
That's where you can get it. Go find it. And, you know, check out the book trailer, too. It's out on YouTube, and you can find it on my Facebook and everywhere and, you know, social media.
The book is Shortcut, a Jason Max thriller. We'd like to thank our guest, Brian Thomas Smith, for his most intelligent conversation. And, of course, we give special thanks to our listeners who take the time to give us a voice in their lives. Remember, we offer a fresh topic every week. Check us out on the Hudson River Radio Facebook page. Leave us a comment, too. We'd also like that you like you to consider sharing Being Frank with others. And of course, at the end of the day, I'd like to leave you a couple of last nuggets. One of them that I'm sure Brian will appreciate from Dorothy Parker. I share it with my students all the time at Fordham when she said, "I hate writing. I love having written. Writing is hard, folks. Believe me, I think Brian would agree with that. Afterwards, you like to say, I'm a writer, but boy, it's pretty hard to do. Because we've got some music from Joe Durso from his new album, Thurman, a tribute to Thurman Munson. The song is Taken by Storm. You've been watching Being Frank, where the only way to be is Frank. We like to call it intelligent conversation. We hope you think so, too. We hope to see you next Thursday. I'm your host, Frank Lobono. This has been Being Frank. Next time. The heavens open wide.
This is HudsonRiverRadio.com.